Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 25 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. You can also think of this podcast as being about films from the VHS era, though we do not necessarily watch these films on the VHS format. And our film for this episode is Ghostbusters, and it is from 1984. And we watched it on CED, the CED Selectivision format, the CED video disc, the format that ruined and bankrupted a major American corporation. And we got this on eBay because Ghostbusters was the last CED ever made. We will never review a newer film
than Ghostbusters
or watch a newer CED than this CD of Ghostbusters, which came out 6 months after the CEO of RCA said, keep buying the players, we're going to stop manufacturing the players, but don't worry, we're going to manufacture discs for another 10 years. And 6 months later they made Ghostbusters and they were out. Yeah, I mean, it's freaking Ghostbusters. Super mega hit from the 80s, made something like $200 million on a $20 million budget.
It was actually closer to $300 million.
Closer to $300 million.
Like a $25 to $30 million budget, and it made almost $300 million. I don't think that includes sales of VHS.
CED, video disc, VHS.
Yeah, I don't think it includes all of that. So it's
It's been a mega hit.
Yeah.
And also, of course, we're doing this now because there's yet another Ghostbusters, I guess, in the original universe. And then there was a reboot, and then there was also the sequel, and then the reboot of the sequel, and like whatever.
40 years later.
We're still talking about Ghostbusters. There are people who go around town in Pittsburgh. There is somebody in town with an Ecto-1 Pennsylvania license plate, and they will wear those
Proton packs
and the jumpsuits, the color. What's the color? The name of the color is beige.
Beige
jumpsuits and all of that. There's a fan culture around this film.
It's huge.
Still with us.
Yes.
And do we need to do the brief plot? So also, on our initial critical reactions, I loved this movie when I was 7.
Yes.
I loved it when I was seven. It was just in my mind so big and so epic and so kind of grown up.
Yeah.
In a way.
But I mean, I guess a quick, you know, it's three college professors who are kicked out of their
university.
They decide to start this business called Ghostbusters, and they go around capturing ghosts. And at the end of the film, they have to fight the big bad.
Yes, the big bad, and save the city of New York, and by extension, probably the world.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the plot. That's all you need to know.
Yes.
So let's get down to the meat of this podcast. Revisiting this film in the 2020s, and maybe the first place to start is actually our binge watch of Dark Side of Comedy.
Yes.
If you're clicking on play, oh, Ghost, they're going to talk about Ghostbusters, and I remember Ghostbusters, and I remember that movie when I was a kid, and we might ruin your childhood for a minute here. I can't help but think about how what was revealed in Dark Side of Comedy, the episode on John Belushi is his own tragedy, yeah. But John Belushi is the big tragedy, and that as John Belushi was spiraling and in deep trouble, Dan Aykroyd was sort of panic writing this film.
Yeah.
Because he knew that if they just had a big hit movie together, so many problems would be solved.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I guess you could say Dan Aykroyd didn't write fast enough, or John Belushi just spiraled fast enough. I think that's what it really is. And so for me, there's now knowing that there is a darkness to this movie.
Yes.
That they still, I mean, life goes on. You know, you enlist Bill Murray. You write the character Slimer in as an homage to John Belushi. But for me, there's always this twinge of tragedy now when you think about it.
Yeah.
That, like, he was conceiving this thing and there was this hope and love for each other. and this hope that, you know, in the future that they would have this future together, keep making movies, keep being buddies and being successful. And, you know, John Belushi's been gone, 45 years now.
82. I think he died in 82.
So 42 years. Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, it's like Aykroyd, obviously his love for Belushi to try to do this. But, you know, Belushi, I looked it up, and he actually, John Belushi only did 8 films.
Wow.
And then Blues Brothers was in 1980, and that was, like, just such a huge film. So, 78, yeah. You had Animal House, where everybody was talking about John Belushi. And
yeah.
All that. Then they do Blues Brothers together, which is a massive hit. And then he tries Continental Divide, where he is actually doing acting. Like, he's playing a real character. It's not about the persona of John Belushi. It's actually a good film, Continental Divide, but it doesn't really do well. There's mixed reactions. And then Aykroyd and Belushi get back together for Neighbors, which is a pitch black comedy. It's a very dark
film.
Dark film. And they switch roles. John Belushi is not the manic one in the film. He's actually the stable, normal guy. And it did okay. It wasn't a huge hit, but it was, like, critically panned. A lot of
Yeah,
people.
We should do Neighbors sometime.
We should. I think Ebert liked it.
Ebert liked it. I mean, it's a very strange and interesting film that, yeah, cuts against the persona and I think cuts against what now the public memory of John Belushi is. It's such an interesting film.
Yeah.
And we do own it on CED. And I think VHS. So we should at some point slide a copy of Neighbors in a player and do that.
And I think, so for Belushi, you know, in his spiral as well, like his career wasn't panning out the way he thought it was. And then also our understanding of addiction is much different now than it was then. And so I think Aykroyd feeling like, oh, if I wrote this film, it would save his life. And unfortunately, just with addiction, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but I mean, you think, what a tremendous act of love.
Oh, a huge act of love. A huge act of
and
love.
And an attempt to, yeah. So I can't divorce now. We can't unknow this.
And there's obviously then like a sadness to the situation.
Yeah.
Because, and Belushi actually, I'm sorry, Aykroyd was working on the screenplay when he found out Belushi died as well.
Yeah.
And so that sadness is huge. Also, it was a much different film than what we saw. So originally, Aykroyd and Belushi were going to be traveling through time and space and catching ghosts and other beings, you know, throughout space and time. And so it would have been a much different film.
Yeah.
Than what we have. And when Ivan Reitman came along, he just said, Aykroyd, we can't film this. Like, we don't have a budget for something like this. We have to tone it down. And they brought in Harold Ramis to rewrite it and for those two to work together. And so that you kind of, the what we know now is not what the
what was the original idea. And yeah, I think there's, well, okay, so that's the future that never was.
Yeah.
Or maybe the past that never was. And now we're living in the future and looking at a film in the past. And I don't know what to say about this film. I think we insider baseball people, we usually watch these films, we do a little research sometimes while the movie's going on, if it's a little slow. And then sometimes we just kind of, you know, pull the disc, cartridge, cassette, whatever, out of the player.
Yeah.
Let the dogs out. Come up into my office, and hit record on the Tascam and
just
start making
it.
The podcast. And honestly, I couldn't because last night I just could not think of anything to really say about this film.
So I think
we needed some time to think about
it.
I did at least.
And I think, you know, so as you mentioned at the start, we saw it as kids. We didn't see it in the theater. We both saw it on HBO. And when we were younger seeing it, so we would have been 8, 9 when we saw it. It felt huge. It really felt huge.
And it was epic. And it was this long journey.
Yes.
And it, one of the things actually that struck me about watching it today, and maybe just because the 2+ hour movie is now the almost sort of industry imperative. It's not longer than 2 hours. It's not a real movie.
Yeah.
This movie is incredibly efficient in its storytelling.
I think it's like around 105
minutes. 105 yeah. minutes. You set up, you know, they're in the library, they're at the library, they're at the university, they get fired, they start being Ghostbusters. I mean, yeah. that feels like now like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot, well, throughout the film there's not a lot of character development, but you sort of establish these guys are sort of scientists, but they're man children.
Yeah.
They get fired, which, as somebody who works in a university, actually the process would be a lot longer and a lot more involved. Anyway, you don't need to know that. And then suddenly they're Ghostbusters. They get to go get a third mortgage on Spangler's house.
Yeah.
And now they're Ghostbusters and they're building a thing and they're in a business.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think because of that, like, quickness, you don't get much backstory, right? So, like, the beginning is a lot of fun because it's the librarian encountering the ghost. That's a lot of fun. But you don't understand why they're getting fired. So, like,
there's a one-dimensional Dean character who's just like, this is your methods are sloppy and we don't like it.
Exactly. So you're fired, and then, you know, they're Venkman and Peter and Ray are talking and decide, hey, let's start this business. And Ray, played by Dan Aykroyd, happens to have this house, so he has then the money to do all this stuff. And they start a business. And because of that, there's like actually really no character development, right?
Yeah.
So it's like the goal was to get to Slimer as quickly as possible, and he got to Slimer as quickly as possible. And then the goal was then to get to the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and that was like the next set goal with
yeah.
that. So they actually don't really like evolve or change as people. And even like the Sigourney Weaver character, he meets her twice.
Yes, and through the media, the second time, because he's famous, she's more into him.
Yeah.
The door is open for her to be interested in him. Which I think is also weird, like, for the character. I mean, I guess the Sigourney Weaver character changed the most
yes.
throughout the film in more than one way. But even without No Dana, Only Zool. Yeah, you see her kind of twice. They meet twice, and then, like, she's like, okay, let's go on a date. It's just fine. And not weird at all. It was the 80s kids. Wouldn't have been that weird. But yeah, like, she's the one who, her mind changes.
Yeah.
Peter Venkman is just kind of Peter Venkman. Who, and he's sort of incorrigible.
Yes.
And the obstacles that they face get larger.
That's it. And it's like, nobody grows or evolves or changes during the film. It's just, let's get from one bigger obstacle to the next bigger obstacle. And it's a kind of a bummer, though, because, like, Sigourney Weaver, and at that time, she was Alien. Like, Alien and Aliens.
Yeah.
Like, she was known as an action star and known as a dramatic actress. And for her to choose a comedy when she's such a talented actress, she was so underused. Like, she did a great job in the role, but she was so underused. And even Ernie Hudson, who's, like, a really good actor, was also underused. And if you haven't seen Crow, like, he's actually wonderful in Crow, The Crow.
Yeah.
So you also then have, like, these kind of really good actors who are kind of... Even Annie Potts is a, you know...
Annie Potts is a good actor, actress,
know.
Yeah. I mean, Bill Murray became Bill Murray.
Yeah.
I will say, though, in one defense of... I was texting with a dear friend who reveres this film and is totally psyched about seeing the new one, or has seen the new one already, says that her argument was, this is like Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
And it's not Sherlock's Holmes and Watson. Those characters are set up. It's solving the mystery.
Oh, that's an interesting take.
Okay. That is an interesting take, and so they're not supposed to... I think my counter-argument was, and, you know, the start of baseball season is very soon, and this is a thought, a movie like Major League, which is just as goofy and juvenile
mm-hmm.
and about man-children, I like that film partially because every guy in that film has to overcome something about themselves to make them both a better ball player and a better teammate.
Yes.
And I love that about that film. Ghostbusters, and again, as an adult looking back and maybe having 40-some years of being around men who just do not learn.
Yeah.
And who just sort of, like, wait for the Sigourney Weaver to come around to who they are. And that those men run everything in the world right now and cannot be talked to and cannot be moved off their position. Maybe that's part of my hang-up of watching this movie in the 2020s.
Well, so, you know, Ghostbusters 2, which is was definitely not as successful as Ghostbusters and is a bit more maligned than Ghostbusters. But the thing about it is there's actually character development that happens in there because it starts with them actually that they're not beloved anymore, right? In the beginning of Ghostbusters 2, the Ghostbusters, the company has failed. Ray and Winston are actually doing children's shows.
Yes, birthday parties.
Peter Venkman is like doing a cheesy like psychic show. Egon actually has a real job. But you know, and Bill Murray at that point has lost Dana. They've broken up because he's a jerk, and she got married and had a child with another man, and he actually grows as a person. By the end, because he cares more about her and her child and what's going to happen than himself, right?
Yes.
And so you would say in the first one, he does decide to help save New York City and the world,
and they risk their lives.
Lives, but it's not necessarily because he had some sort of epiphany. I don't know. Or that he's, like, had this whole character arc along the way where he's now suddenly worried about doing the best for others. It's just he's put in this situation in this moment, and he makes that particular decision. So Ghostbusters, in some ways, is a little bit more interesting because you do see this growth.
Ghostbusters 2, that is.
Ghostbusters 2, where you do see this growth that happens over time. But no, not in Ghostbusters. And I think as a kid, that's cool. It's cool to go from, like, one action to another action
to another
action.
And I think is also, kids who grew up as we did on episodic television.
Yeah.
Where, every Tuesday night at 9 o'clock, it's or 8 o'clock probably. That was past my bedtime at that point because I was 7 when this movie came out. That there's just a reset button. Every Tuesday night at 8, boop, same people, new problems.
exactly.
Larry and Balky, what are they going to get into this week? They're not learning anything. There's a moral for you, the audience, but then Larry's going to be the same jerk, and Balky's going to be the same innocent, fine, kind-hearted, naive immigrant every week, and that's just fine and dandy. In a way, this movie is is it a 101-minute sitcom?
I think that's a good way to put it. It's definitely a good way to put it. And with comic relief, with, like, Rick Moranis playing Lewis, right?
Which I think is one of the things that, like, looking back, Rick Moranis is the real star of Ghostbusters.
Oh, my gosh.
He's so good. He sends it so hard, all gas, no brakes, in every scene of that film. Holding nothing back, playing this, like, deliciously ridiculous but somehow still believable but so much fun character. I think that, and for me, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I think I would give this movie a more negative review, but to think about, like, also a major Hollywood film that has such an incredible left field twist at the end that is the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. That's so
good. Which wasn't his original, that was one of his original ideas that he had.
Yes,
which I'm glad they kept it.
But could you imagine getting that past the finance department, script department today?
Oh.
Wait, is a marshmallow? I don't get it. That's not going to play. And it's just so whimsical and so, for me, it's like, it's so good. Again, because it's that moment is
brilliant.
Is so brilliant.
I guess they originally wanted to cast John Candy as Lewis, and he just couldn't get the character, and he passed on it. But I can't imagine, you know, like, I love John Candy, but Harold Ramis just does such a good job. Not Harold Ramis, I'm sorry. Rick Moranis.
Same kind of, those names rhyme.
Does such a good job with Lewis, and I love this scene where it's just like he's also just completely oblivious to everything, and you know, he's not getting that Dana's not interested in him, and when he finds out she has a date and she's like, "We'll stop by," he's like, "Oh, okay." Like, he's just like such this like oblivious, lovable character that you just so adore him.
And I think also what a send up on, you know, thinking about New York in the 80s.
Yeah.
And Reagan's America in the 80s, where, you know, I mean, you think that's the character, the EPA inspector's character,
Walter Peck.
Walter Peck, yes, Walter Peck. William Afton, he's really good in this too. Yeah. Walter Peck, they have the cast list on the back of the CED, people, so I can grab that. Walter Peck, you know, is the epitome of the Ronald Reagan quote that won him several elections and has kind of turned America into the massive dumpster fire that it is. You know, no one wants to hear the words no one wants to hear, you know, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help." He is the epitome of that Ronald Reagan mantra, which, of course, again, America, giant dumpster fire. He is that. I think it's also that Rick Moranis character about money and this over concern about money and the sort of like, as you made the point, you know, in terms of films and other contexts, Taxi Driver was 76.
Yeah.
And just, you know, there's one joke about the neighborhood where the firehouse is being not so great, but it's the new New York. Not quite the Giuliani, you know, broken windows New York, but it's this new 80s spirit of New York City where there's all of this money and yuppies
everywhere.
And he's this guy who has the financial knowledge who just doesn't make it quite work, and he's not cool.
Right.
Which is very, I think, period specific.
Yes.
But I think that character has just such that sort of Buster Keaton-esque absurdity to him that it's still a good character today.
And also, you know, the apartment building is right by Central Park, which now, like, now as we're adults,
like, now you couldn't imagine, yeah.
Well, how did he as an accountant and her as a violinist afford yes. that apartment? But it is, yes, that part for me is interesting because the conversation we had about Taxi Driver is Taxi Driver was all about the grittiness and danger of New York City, where in Ghostbusters, yeah, it's mentioned once and that's it, and it's just about kind of living in New York City,
yeah,
which is kind of fascinating, right? And so and they're going to different sites to catch ghosts, but it's not anything about it being like New York City is dangerous. So it's the sense of the
it's
new
the
new
ghosts
York.
Are dangerous, and there's money in New York, and there's a character to New York, which is funny because you think like Dan Aykroyd doing Chicago so well, or making this whimsical Chicago in Blues Brothers, but also then making this whimsical New York City in Ghostbusters, which I wish Dan Aykroyd did more things like that. I think the other thing is you were talking about, like, because, you know, I pulled the CED out of the player, and I was like, why do people care about this movie so much?
Yeah.
And you made the point.
Yeah, that there just wasn't many children-friendly films at that point in time. I pulled up a list, and I think I read
of the big 84 films.
And there was maybe five. So there was Neverending Story, Muppets Take Manhattan, I believe. This, maybe some families would have taken you to Gremlins. I think Footloose, maybe some families would have taken you to Footloose. But there was maybe five or six of the 150 films. And there was more I could have scrolled through. I think I made up to 185.
And you think about it, this is the movie I think most, I mean, it's the epitome of Hollywood marketing that you have the crossover appeal.
Yeah.
It could be a date movie. It's sort of an action movie. It's sort of a kids movie, but the parents won't fall asleep.
Yeah.
Which I think now in our, you know, I think Pixar is maybe waning, or that formula is kind of falling apart a little bit, but part of, you know, the whole Pixar thing was, you know, those are kids' movies that parents won't hate watching.
The same with the Lego movies.
Lego movies, yeah. As well.
So, but yeah, at that time, there wasn't a ton of films. And so you think Muppet Takes Manhattan specifically for kids.
Yes.
Neverending Story was more for kids. Ghostbusters was trying to create this film that's about a group of 40-something men. It's three 40-something men. And you're dragging your kid to see a movie about three 40-something men who have lost their careers, they're having midlife crises, and they're trying to find their path in life. If you pitched it that way, what parent would take their child to that film? But they were able to do a really good job of balancing, like, the humor. The horror is not too scary. It would be scary for an 8-year-old, but not too scary, right?
Yeah.
So it balances humor and horror, and the pacing is quick as well for it. And so there wouldn't have been a ton there. So there is the, you know, the playground talk, right? Kids would have been like, oh, did you go see Ghostbusters? Oh, it's on HBO. I watched it. It was good. But there also would have been the water cooler talk, like, oh, I took my kids to Ghostbusters and not too bad. If you need to take your kids somewhere, take them here, or calling up grandma and grandpa, take the kids to Ghostbusters. They can say it.
And so here's the other thing about Ghostbusters now I think about it. There's two horror movies that I want to speak about Ghostbusters 2 in context. Because you said the other thing about the horror, the special effects are not too scary. And you think about what it does too, the ghosts aren't that scary, but also there is a way of fighting back against ghosts in Ghostbusters, which, as somebody once said, I saw a documentary about The Exorcist, and what makes The Exorcist so terrifying is, especially for Catholic, is the priest can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Oh, if the priest can't do anything about the supernatural, uh-oh, we are in big trouble. And that's terrifying, that lack of control.
Yes.
And so Ghostbusters, yes, there's ghosts and ghouls and things happening and skeletons driving taxi cabs, but they got these proton packs, you see, and they got these traps, and you could, you know, whatever, no matter what, you can bust open a trap. Which for me then also, in terms of how this movie appeals to our generation so much to the point where we won't let it go, and then a lot of our friends are infecting their own children with this film, is this is the redemption for all of us who watched Poltergeist when we were way too young and unsupervised, and it was on HBO seemingly at least 3 times a day.
It's true.
Because I think I watched Poltergeist when I was 6.
Yeah.
And my big Pink Panther doll that was kind of long and lanky, like the clown in Poltergeist, found the back of my closet, and there was a door, a chair wedged under the door handle for about 6 months of my childhood. And yeah, I never loved that giant Pink Panther doll ever again. And I think it had to go away because of Poltergeist. And that movie terrified me. And some of the special effects look very similar to Poltergeist. And then they get blasted with proton beams and put away. And I think
that was
the real market for this film, was kids who saw Poltergeist on HBO way younger than they had any right to and were permanently scarred by it. Ghostbusters is your redemption.
Well, I also think that, you know, I always say, like, Gen X, Generation X, is the first generation of rampant divorce, right? Like, it's the first generation where divorce is just happening. And not that divorce didn't
happen.
It's
just so normal. And you could talk about it, and so many kids.
And the divorce rate definitely went up around that time. And so I also think there's that sense of, I think often when you have instability in your life, it's nice to have a comfort. And I think Ghostbusters became a comfort for people.
Yeah.
And it's a comfort as well as, like, they solve the problems and everything's okay. And they're funny.
And they're heroes. And
they're heroes. And this is nice. And my dad might be frumpy and 40-ish. And these guys are frumpy and 40-ish.
And my stepdad might suck.
My stepdad might suck. I think there was a comfort in that film, in that particular film around it. Now, in today's market, like, if Ghostbusters was a brand new concept, right? But it's competing against Marvel, and it's competing against Pixar, and it's competing against Disney, and it's competing against all this other stuff. I don't know if it would have today made
and
300
which is
million.
Maybe why the three films that have come out recently, the three Ghostbusters, have kind of not landed.
Well, I not landed the same way. I didn't look them up. Like, but Frozen Empire is getting some negative reviews. I know for that. But I think...
Yeah, I think Irish Times called it the worst movie of the year. So far
for this year. I think the other one did kind of okay-ish. But I think it was because Paul Rudd is in it, and Paul Rudd is kind of charming and lovable. But I do think in the cultural context of the time, and that they really weren't necessarily marketing films to kids...
Or, again, something that has such broad crossover. It's also a bit of a rom-com.
It is.
They squeezed a little rom-com. There is that idea about, and we read this in a screenwriting magazine years ago, that a lot of major studio pictures just kind of like, there's a day when these script doctors just, you know, they're in a conference room somewhere in a building in Hollywood, and it's like, okay, those are the 16 to 35 year old male guys, and they're gonna go through and make sure that there's enough in this script that a 16 to 35 year old male would be into this.
Yeah.
And then there's the date movie people, and then there's the stand-up comics with stage fright who punch up scripts to make sure they're a little funny, or if it needs to be funny.
Yeah.
And that you maybe sometimes don't have the single authored film so much anymore, but the film that is written by committee, and that continuity and storytelling is actually a matter of the editor, who then has to put all of these pieces together and tell a coherent story, because they just shoot a bunch of stuff that a bunch of people wrote. This film actually like kind of fulfills that promise or that idea that you can appeal to all of these people at the same time at some level. It's an action, rom-com, horror, comedy, children's movie that with slight bits of adult humor and I
we even talked about this, like that, like Beetlejuice is in the same line as this. Yes. And I think Shaun of the Dead, which I actually think it does better.
Yes.
Because Shaun of the Dead actually is legitimately really scary in some parts.
Yes.
But I think Shaun of the Dead, in making kind of this comedy, also really understood zombie films.
And all of that, and is super smart. And, oh, by the way, Shaun has to grow as a human being.
He does.
To also overcome this, which I just love that in storytelling. And now that I teach fiction writing workshop, I think lack of character development is unforgivable. So I think, is there anything else before we go to the big five?
No, that's all right,
let's go to the big five questions. And question one, if there's not enough hot takes yet in this film, I think I have one coming. Question one is it camp, retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
I think it's just an old movie.
I think it's just an old movie, too. And that's a hot take, and maybe we're bad Gen Xers and we lose our Gen X membership cards. Or we go through a probationary period, generational probationary period. Or get put on an improvement plan, and maybe we finally do Star Wars on May 4th. Which, by the way, would be my first time trying to watch Star Wars all the way through.
Oof.
Where I would actually watch it all the
we
way
should,
through.
We should
I've
do it.
Seen pieces of Star Wars. The Matchbox cars on the living room floor were always more interesting to me than that film.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I could do it at 40, whatever my age is. It's just an old movie.
Yeah.
It's just, sorry. Is this for our generation? Because we grew up, you know, there was that like faux, like, because, you know, 89 was the 20th anniversary of Woodstock.
Yeah.
And like boomer culture was having this moment.
Yeah.
Is Ghostbusters the cinematic equivalent of boomers in 1990 trying to sell younger people on The Doors? Is this the cinematic The Doors?
I think it might be. And you know,
I just made myself sad. It was sadder than the John Belushi thing.
Ghostbusters, looking towards the past, is Abbott and Costello, right? Like, it is those kind of early comedies, and Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, or Abbott and Costello in a haunted house. That's what this is, right? And so, do people love those movies? Absolutely. But they're just still movies, right? And that's okay. It's all right sometimes if something's old. You can still love something that's old, but it's just an old movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So question two, which actually is another hot take here. What about the social political distance? I think we have to talk about Peter Venkman as a creeper.
He is a creeper. And I think
he is a creeper. He is someone in Sigourney Weaver's position would not put up with him at all.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning of the film, though, with how he was interacting with the student.
This is true.
Female student, the male student, and he was trying to see if they were psychic and they could read his mind as he was holding, you know,
that scene, yeah.
And though she was getting it wrong, he wasn't shocking her.
Because he wanted to meet her for, he wanted to date one of his students.
Which, ew.
Ew!
Right, ew. Even if she was a grad student. Ew.
Still sketch.
So still sketch. Because she was probably 20-something and he is in his 40s. Still ew. So that part is kind of ew.
Ew.
Ew with it. And I agree with you. Like Sigourney Weaver, who, Dana is accomplished. She's intelligent. She kind of has her own life. Is she really going to fall for this kind of schlub of a guy? Probably not, right? Like, I think that's the reality of it.
Which is also so interesting, too, because you think part of it is, you know, isn't that the same way Rick Moranis treats her?
Yeah. And she's
and
not interested.
One is, like, completely ridiculously comedic and pathetic.
Yeah.
And the other one is finally she comes around once Peter Venkman gets famous.
I think the other thing we also have to... So, yes. So, that's kind of, like, weird. And then they cut it. There was a... They show it in a montage, just briefly. But there was also a storyline where Dan Aykroyd falls in love with a ghost. And so, we see briefly in the montage of her, obviously, giving him, you know...
Pleasure of some kind.
That was also cut, but also kind of, even as a kid, that scene I always thought was weird. That montage was, that part of the montage was always weird. So it's a little strange, like that kind of shit.
A little strange. I mean, I think there's some stuff in about, you know, like New York is the diverse city, and so there is some kind of things about race that are a little weird. Some characters that are very much stereotypes.
Yeah.
You know, you call them up from Central Casting in 1950-something.
Yeah.
They happen to be in this 80s movie.
The other thing I have to talk about, too, I think this is the place to talk about it, is because of the, like, rabid fandom, the reboot with an all-female cast with Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy. It just was horribly reviewed. Like, just people... tore it apart, like especially male fans tore the film apart, and I know partially it's because the big bad in it ended up being an incel type character, and the
big bad ended up being the exact sort of character who would write a mean review of an all female Ghostbusters
and
reboot on the internet.
And I will say the female one actually has like character development and actually has a plausible reason why at least Kristen Wiig's character is fired. Like, so it actually does have character arc and growth, and it's also you have to, former friends have to repair the relationship. Like, so it's kind of like this interesting journey they have to take to get to the point where they can save the world.
Yeah.
They have to come together as friends again, and they have to mend this relationship, and they have to grow as people to save the world. I actually really liked it. And as a woman, it's really nice to see the female characters winning and being the heroes in a film. But the fandom around it is just so intense and toxic that this film was just, it just had no hope, right, out of the gate. Had no hope out of the gate. And that part is kind of ugly. And this is also happening with the Marvels. The Marvel film or Captain Marvel or whatever it's called. That also happened because, like, people just are mad about the female character. They don't like her and they don't like that she doesn't smile. So that also is kind of weird, too, because I do think on the other side of the coin, it's like sometimes when fans get so rabid, it doesn't allow for different interpretations.
Different interpretations or honest interpretations. Or, like I said, I mean, I think this movie is so revered and we might, you know... Sometimes friends reach out, like, what are you guys thinking about this movie? So the next thing, actually, to talk about in terms of hot takes, because it was such an important part of how this movie was perceived in 1984, but to watch it again, and granted, we don't have a 4K TV, we still have a 1080p.
Yeah.
As you can hook all these old-fashioned things into it, and I don't know if this TV goes, what the future of this podcast is. But what about the technical distance of the film? And I think we have to talk about the effects.
Yeah.
And they didn't age well. There's early CGI and there's stop motion animation.
And there's separate.
There's the two big... There's other practical effects, like, you know, the scene where Dana comes home and the eggs fly out of the carton and sizzle on the countertop. Those look great. That looks good still. Some of the stuff...
The scene where she's in the chair and the arms grab her, like, that looks good.
That still looks good.
But, you know, the building, the apartment building, and I feel bad for anyone who went to New York City looking for the apartment building, the top floors are matte painting, and you can tell. So there's scenes where they're showing the building, and you can tell it's a painting.
Yeah.
And it just looked really bad.
And again, even on CD... I mean, granted, we both were exposed to this film on CRT TV.
Yeah.
The Oaks did it as a moonlit matinee.
I believe so,
didn't we go? We went to that. We did go to that. We did see it on the big screen once.
But you can tell the matte paintings look really, really bad. And I think the demon dogs.
The frame ratio on the claymation. Where the demon dogs are claymation.
Just don't look great.
And this is also a film that has some early sort of CGI... animated effects. I guess you wouldn't really technically call it CGI, but you know what I mean.
Right.
It doesn't look... I mean, much like the effects now in Poltergeist, which in the mid-80s were terrifying and spectacular, and you'd never seen anything that clear and vivid and scary ever again.
Yeah, but as adults...
Adults now are
just so used to seeing these, like, things amazing effects.
But this was such a huge part of the film.
Yeah.
And the appeal of the film was the spectacle. And they're just left with storytelling, and the story is what it is. Question 4. Well, what was it like to watch this film on, again, the last CED ever made?
So, because it's a record, and it's a record inside a housing, but if any dust gets on it or anything, it really messes with it. So there was skipping that actually happened.
This movie skipped a lot.
And actually, at the beginning, it was actually kind of funny as the books were floating.
In the library, in the first haunting scene in the library, the books were, like, flying off the shelves and then going back on the shelves and back off the shelves. And so that was kind of trippy.
Yeah.
But
so the challenge is, yes, so we got skipping in it, and that was not great.
It skipped quite a bit at the beginning of both sides. So here's the other thing. It is like a record, folks. If you don't know what CD is. If you don't know what CD is, go watch the Tech Moan on it.
Yeah.
That guy does this exhausting, and most of what I know about CED comes from that Tech Moan episode on YouTube. You got to flip the record over.
Yes.
You do have to stop. The movie stops after about 55 minutes. And I got to get up, get the plastic cartridge, walk all the way across the room, shove the plastic cartridge into the machine. It spits the whole thing out. You flip it over. You shove the big plastic cartridge back in. And then it shoots the shell out and holds onto the record and plays. And the beginning of both sides were extremely glitchy. because dust literally permanently fuses to. So actually, this CED, it's either because we drug a needle through it, is going to play a lot better next time if we ever try to watch this again on CED, or it will be completely unplayable forever. I'm not sure what's going to happen.
And the pause here wasn't horrible, but also sometimes they weren't thoughtful of when you have to flip it.
Yes.
And so sometimes you could be in the middle of like an intense scene and it's like, eject, 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 and flip.
Yeah, the screen just turns black and then it turns blue, so, and then it makes horrible noises and you have to do all this stuff. Yeah. So that was part of it.
We actually didn't know if it would eject because it was skipping so bad towards
At the end of the credits, it was skipping so bad that I had to really force the eject button.
Yeah.
And,
It came out.
It's here. The player still works. Which, again, is, you know, plugging that into a 1080p. I mean, our friend was trying to watch something that they loved on DVD, that they still had on DVD, and actually going from 1080p DVD to 4K, their 4K screen, they actually had to stop and just, we own this, but we better watch this in streaming. Like, it was too much for them. So to even go from, you know, the CED that would have been on a probably 20-inch CRT TV that we would have all watched from a distance across the room, and it would have been enough for us back then, and we liked it. Seeing it now on, I don't know, how big is our TV? 47 inches.
Something like that.
Something like that, 1080p from like 2008, through CED was, didn't look great. VHS looks better.
Yeah.
Laserdisc looks better. We also own this movie on Betamax.
Yeah.
That was actually the thing. If this stopped working, I would have went and grabbed the Betamax and watched it. Looks better. But you do really notice how bad the effects are.
Right.
You know, without upscaling.
Not that Ghostbusters is ever going to go away on streaming because it's so beloved. But also the other thing is that, like, as we know, actually stuff goes off of streaming, right?
Yes.
And so having a physical copy of something, though, even though it could be bad, is nice because
it's nice. It is still fun and it's still a unique experience.
Yeah.
And I think the next question, will we ever watch it again? And I think the circumstance would be we have friends over who are, oh, by the way, fascinated by our machines, all of my machines. Oh, you want to watch Ghostbusters on CED? You want to watch Ghostbusters on Betamax? Somebody would do that. I think if we had friends over, that is how I would watch this movie again. I think I'm done with Ghostbusters.
So you know,
I think I'm done. But if a friend was like, can we watch it on that format that ruined the company? Okay, I'll go to the basement and go get it.
So in terms of comfort movies, which is, it's a comfort movie for many people. It's something you remember from your childhood. It has a positive association. You want to watch it again. And I don't remember, I think it was an article I read years ago, but it was the leaving the shower test. So if you just got out of the shower and you have the TV on in the background and you're in a towel, if the movie was on the TV, would you sit down still dripping wet in your towel and watch that movie? And it's not one of those.
No, not for me anymore, no.
And I feel like, for me, I keep going back to, like, Rosemary's Baby. If I turn on the TV and Rosemary's Baby's on, I'm probably sitting down. I'm like, oh, it's that scene. I got to watch that scene. It's not one of those films for me. I think at a time, it probably was when I was younger. You know, definitely when I was younger. Actually, I would have been excited whenever it was on when I was younger.
Yeah.
But now, and I think it's just because our tastes have actually changed and evolved over time. And I think that there are films that we do like silly films. You know, there are definitely films that we like. Like, we love Shaun of the Dead. If Shaun of the Dead pops on, I'm watching Shaun of the Dead.
I think for me, like I said, a movie like Major League, which is also completely juvenile and has some political correctness issues and is about man children and is meant to be a silly comedy.
Yeah.
There's something I love about that movie because it's just better storytelling. I mean, there are scenes in this movie that I love. I think that's the other thing, is sitting down and watching this movie, and maybe the format to own this movie in, for us and the podcast purposes, is Laserdisc.
Yeah.
Because you can skip. I mean, this Lewis's party scene is great.
It is.
Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. so great. Much fun.
Yeah.
Slimer's fun.
Yeah.
And it's also, I think, part of what happened for me watching this movie this time and having to sit there and sit through the whole thing is there's these bits and bites and memories of this is like experiencing this movie in memory like a sketch comedy show.
Yeah.
Or an episode of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, okay, this is 101 minutes of you're going to hear a whole story. Yeah. But some of those scenes I would revisit willingly and have fun with, you know, Lewis's part. Again, Lewis's party is so good, you know.
But it's not a film that we're going to be like, oh, it's Friday night, it's cold, we don't want to go outside, what should we pop on? It's not a film that we're popping on.
Or, hey, that's on cable tonight.
Yeah.
Unless we're also maybe stuck in a hotel room somewhere. And literally there's you know, bad now, the worst hotel TV cable.
Yeah.
Is like hotel cable has really gone downhill.
Yeah.
So you talk about the degeneration of our society.
Yeah.
Hotel cable is now the worst. I think that's it. I think we've destroyed enough people's childhoods and ragged on a beloved film enough.
I think we're good.
I think we've done enough evil today. And it's a 51-minute podcast.
Wow.
Considering I thought I had nothing to say about Ghostbusters last night.
We just needed to mull over.
Yeah, we did. All right.
Bye.